ruffled beat of clouds below your knees by Ray Lynch. Signals Wednesday, 8 p.m. and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. We are honored to be placed in this coveted spot here Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. where Jay Liu and his crew on Tech Bites had been for so many years. We've been on for a month now, and I think it's working out. Well, you guys out there in Radio Land, let us know. Now, stay tuned, because you will hear some wonderful stories here. I'm Mary Edgerton, one of the co-hosts of this wonderful show, and along with the rest of our team, our show creator and co-host Dr. Hank Rubicek, my other co-hosts Warren Holloman and Greg Audell, engineer Nicole Rocherlin, syndicator Alondra Mejia, and the newest member of our squad, Lisa Moore. We celebrate the power of story by bringing you storytellers who will take us on journeys through their worlds, and through the windows of their souls with personal stories that bring us together as humans. Tonight, we have Robert, or Bob Dempsey, seasoned flight director with NASA. Bob, or Dr. Bob, as his colleagues call him, is an astronomer by training. He received his PhD at the University of Toledo and worked with the Space Telescope Science Institute, working on the Hubble telescope for many years. He then joined NASA in 1997, where he is currently one of about two dozen flight directors. To those of you who were alive in the 1960s, like me, or who remember seeing the film Apollo 13, a flight director is the maestro who orchestrates the mission. Coupled with these incredible challenges, Bob is a longtime fan of stories. As a story listener, Bob, until recently, had not yet realized his own talents as a storyteller. He wondered, if I had a story to tell, would I be able to deliver it effectively to an audience? Well, his first foray was at the Moth Storytelling Slam in Houston. And yes, that very first night up, he was the winner, telling his story to over 500 listeners. So Bob, he realized that he really is a storyteller. Or I should say you realized you are a storyteller. And I just want to say out there to Radioland, for any of you who haven't unleashed the story within you, listen up and know that all of us, including you, have stories to tell. Best to get inspired by listening to Bob tell us about his journey to becoming a flight director at NASA. You are in for a treat. Bob, welcome to the show.
Good evening. Welcome to be here. Thanks. Good to be here, I should say.
And just how was it the first time you got up in front of that audience at the Moth?
It was not as scary as I thought, but that's partly because I really didn't know what to expect.
That's funny. Okay. Tell us, now tell us, I did mention you were going to tell us about how you came to be a flight director. You'd been an astronomer. So can you tell us that story?
Yes. One of my earliest memories is of doing a spacewalk. However, my spacesuit was a robe stuffed with towels, and my tether was the robe's belt tied to my bed, which was actually my spaceship. Basically, from the earliest day, I always wanted to explore space. So early on, as early as anyone in my family can remember, I said that I wanted to be an astronaut. But unfortunately, I realized when I was diagnosed with needing glasses that I wasn't going to be able to become a fighter pilot. And in those days, it was a fighter pilot that had the right stuff to become an astronaut. However, I knew that NASA needed scientists, and the shuttle program was beginning to ramp up, and they were planning to use scientists as mission specialists. So I decided to follow my passion in science, and astronomy in particular, and become a scientist. So I went off, got my bachelor's and master's and PhD in astronomy and physics. And even though I wanted to work at a place like Jet Propulsion Laboratory or NASA, I got more and more into research on stars. In fact, what I was doing was figuring out how to get a two- or three-dimensional image of a star based on the data we could see in a telescope. And slowly, I had a research program going and doing more work on that. And it was a little bit like being a twig on a river that just kind of carried me along. And eventually, this river carried me to Munich, Germany, where I was doing a research project that was a joint project between NASA and the German government on an X-ray satellite. So in 1991, I was living in Germany for a while, and I was real excited to go over there, not only because of the cultural differences that I was going to experience, but I wanted to learn German. Unfortunately, I did not get much experience in talking German because everyone at the institute, since it was mostly a lot of Europeans, spoke English because that was the common language. But even when I was in town, like one time I lived in a small town outside of Munich, and one time I went into a meat market and I was trying so hard to practice my German, and the little lady behind the counter actually called all the other people over so that she could demonstrate her English. So anyway, I'd been living there a while, and it was the last nice day of the summer, and I decided to ride my bicycle into town to meet a friend of mine to go watch some American football. And we had a good time, and after dinner and everything, it ended up being very late, so I was riding home in the dark. Now, in America, if they were going to do construction on a right-of-way, they would probably put up yellow tape or orange cones or maybe those flashing yellow lights that you sometimes see. Not so much in Germany. So I was riding along on the bike path, and suddenly I pitched over into a hole and hit my head. Now let me back up here for a second, because when I was a child, there was a couple times where I hit my head. One time I was playing baseball with my brothers, and I was the catcher and my older brother was at bat, and I thought it would be very funny if when the ball came down at him, I would jump forward and catch the ball before he could hit it. The net result of that was a bat in the back of my head. That hurt. I bled a little, didn't even go to the doctors, and I just kind of went on with it. There's also another time when I was in high school where I was pruning a tree and apparently grabbed a bad branch and fell down two stories on my head. And that hurt, but again, kind of got up, dusted myself off, and just went on with things. So that night in Germany, when I hit my head, I did the same thing. I got up, saw that there was no broken bones that I could determine, and I got back on my bike and rode home. When I got home, my head was hurting, so I took an aspirin and went to bed. And actually, when I got up in the morning or sometime, my head was really hurting. So I walked into town, got some stronger medicine, went back to my apartment. And the next thing I really remember, I woke up on the bathroom floor. I was throwing up, and I was having difficulty moving the left side of my body. And I quickly realized that I'd hit the right side of my head, and I knew enough physiology that there was a connection here. So I quickly called a friend who took me to the hospital. And initially, when I got to the hospital, the doctor said, you know, we're going to take an X-ray and then maybe an MRI. And if things are bad, we might have to do some surgery, but we'll do that in the morning. So they go off and they take the X-ray. Then they do the MRI. And actually, when I was doing the MRI, I was still coherent enough and enjoying it in a sense, because as the magnets were swirling around my head, I was talking to the technician, because the MRI uses the same software routines to reconstruct an image of your brain that I was using to reconstruct images of stars. So it was actually kind of an interesting moment. But shortly after the MRI, the next thing I know, I'm being wheeled down the hall and IVs are being inserted. And I asked what's going on, because it was like a scene from the TV show ER. And they said, well, we need to do surgery right now. And that's when I kind of realized what kind of dire situation I was in. And I looked at the doctor, and I'm not sure why I was prompted to ask this at this particular time, but I said, is this a good hospital? And he was very reassuring. And then I told him that I needed to let my mom know what was going on. And without skipping a beat, he picked up the phone that was attached to the wall and said, what's the number? So we called my mom, he reassured her, and then I went off into the surgery room. And even then, I think maybe it was the IV starting to take effect or something, I'm not sure, but I do remember commenting to the doctor that due to the greenness of the room and the sparse decoration, that they needed an interior decorator. And then they did put the mask on and said, you know, count back from 100 to 1. And I asked him if he wanted me to do it in German or English because my German wasn't that good and he didn't care. But and I don't remember. I think it was about 98 when I disappeared. So the next thing I remember is waking up in my hospital room. And shortly thereafter, the doctor came in and was examining me. And it was at that point that I discovered how really lucky I was. Because from the time that I'd had the injury to the long time that I had before I got the treatment, typically in those cases, only about 10% of the people live. I got my second shock a couple days later when I was feeling a little bit better and I was reading one of the research papers that I was going to try and get published in the near future. And the doctor came in to check up on me and he looked at me and he says, "You understand that?" And I said, "Yes, of course, I wrote it." And I didn't realize, but he then explained to me that for people that had had an injury like mine and had waited so long and finally gotten surgery, that of those that live, typically only about 10% are permanently mentally handicapped. So it was at that point that I realized how extremely lucky I was. And it was one night when I was laying there in the hospital thinking about it, and while I enjoyed astronomy, I didn't really feel that passion, that desire to explore space like I had had when I was a kid. So when I got back to the U.S., I went off to the Space Telescope Science Institute, as you mentioned. But unfortunately, since I had research grants, I was still kind of doing some research, and it really wasn't what I wanted to do. So at one point, I then just got on a plane, flew down to Houston, where Johnson Space Center was, and knocked on some doors, applied, and eventually got hired to work on the International Space Station program here. And that opened up a lot of opportunities for me, and after a few years of doing that, I was selected as a flight director. And in my time here, I've been on the Vomit Comet. I have dived in the Neutrobuoyancy Lab, which is one of the world's largest pools where we can practice what it's like to walk in space. We've assembled the International Space Station. I have led some very challenging spacewalks and some challenging operations to recover failed systems and worked very closely with the astronauts as we've built an amazing scientific platform. And one of these jobs that I was able to do took me back to Germany, where I was able to go to that bike path and drive by that hospital. And I looked at it, and I didn't feel sadness or pain, but actually happiness, because that was able to take me to exactly where I always wanted to be.
Bob, that's just a wonderful story. And it's amazing how you start out with, as a child, having your spacewalks from your bed, and you end up flight director as people are having spacewalks in space. I mean, that's quite a connection. I do want to say, because I'm a physician, that you did survive a very serious injury. So I want to take out a little public health moment here. Many of you may remember the very talented actress Natasha Richardson, who had the same injury. She walked away from it as you did, but sadly did not realize the seriousness of her injury. So, you've talked about the moment of realizing something was wrong, it having hit your head before. This really entirely was due to your symptoms of vomiting, emesis, as we call it in medical language, and the, what was it, left-sided weakness because you'd hit the right side of your brain. Was there anything else about the injury itself that made you stop and think, should I see a doctor or I'll just go on home?
Yeah, I think since I had hit my head when I was younger, the pain was a bit more than I'd had before. So I knew something was not quite right. However, between not being sure, but also being in a foreign country, I didn't know the language that well. You hear horror stories of people going to hospitals in foreign countries and getting a leg removed, you know, when something wasn't right. Now, granted, Germany was a good place to be, but I was a little bit scared. So I was also a bit in denial, hoping that Tylenol would solve the problem.
Yes, and maybe it's a good thing it was Tylenol, which doesn't thin your blood as aspirin and Motrin would do. So I'm going to throw out there. There are a few rules of thumb for going to see an emergency room. One is you have the worst headache of your life. You've never had a headache like this before. Go to an emergency room. Go now. And don't drive. You might actually have to call an ambulance. Another one is if you hit your head and you have a moment of unconsciousness, go to an emergency room. If you have a headache with vomiting, go to an emergency room. And if you've hit your head harder than any time before, especially if you've been moving because you're a passenger in a car, you're riding a bike, as in this case, or skiing, as in the case of Natasha Richardson, you may not realize the force. Okay. But let's move on from there. And just for a moment, let me remind our audience that we are listening to my guest storyteller, Robert Dempsey, a.k.a. Dr. Bob. And we're going to hear how he got the name Dr. Bob in a bit. On our Wednesday show of So What's Your Story? Only on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 90.9 in Huntsville. And since we are talking to a NASA specialist, let's realize that if you can get on the Internet in space, you can listen to KPFT.org live streaming. For me, that's the way to go. I'm your host, Dr. Mary Edgerton, with Nicole Rocherlin on the boards. And Nicole, we've been on Wednesdays for a month now. How does it feel?
It feels refreshing, and I am well rested.
Yes, it's a lot easier than at 10 p.m. So, hey, Houston's a great storytelling town, and you have some proof. Can you tell us what's going on in Houston?
Absolutely, Mary. Well, to start off, everyone needs to follow us on our Facebook page, and we would love it if you would like us on the way out before you leave. We have program clips on our YouTube channel as well, and all of our past So What's Your Story programs on the Houston Storytellers Guild website at www.houstonstorytellers.org. Just go to the radio program tab and enjoy. Now, the Guild is also our very proud sponsor. Their swaps meet the fourth Tuesday of every month at Temple Emmanuel, located at 1500 Sunset. Also, we hope that you all out there are listening. And I hope you also tuned in to the Liars contest that they sponsored last Saturday, which was a huge event. So hear, hear for all of the Liars, and hear, hear for our show's creator, Dr. Hank Rubicek, who won third place. So congrats to you, Dr. Hank, and don't tell your wife that you have this great talent. Also, don't miss out on our friends at the Moth at Warehouse Live, and that's the second Tuesday of every month.
Well, Hank, now that knowing what a good liar you are, I just don't know if I can ever believe another word you say to me. All right. Hey, and Dr. Bob just sent me a message that said that the International Space Station does get the Internet. So, Bob, yes. I think you need to go back and tell them that on Wednesdays, Central Daylight Time in Houston, and they must know Houston time, right? Houston, we've got a problem, right? They
yes,
know Houston.
They do know the time, though. I will mention that they are asleep now, so they'll have to listen to the podcast.
Okay. Well, tell them to listen to the podcast. Tell them you are on. Okay. Before we hear some more from my guest tonight, I want to let our listeners know that, of course, we'll be back next week, and we will be back at 8 p.m. on Wednesday. And this next time, the rumor is that Warren Holloman will be our host. And it so happens I will be his guest, and we'll be talking about fairy tales, old and updated. This is going to be a fun one. It's going to be a fun one for anybody who's interested in fairy tales, reading fairy tales. I'm really excited about it. As I say, we've got old fairy tales, we have updated fairy tales, we have fairy tales from different points of view, and in fact, even one that I rewrote. So, Bob, let's go back. Let's go back to where you were. You decided on a change of career. You walked up to NASA, and you got a job. And you, besides getting a job, you also got a nickname, Dr. Bob. How'd that go? How'd that happen?
That's correct. When I decided to leave the Space Telescope Science Institute, a lot of people and myself, you know, sort of said, you know, you're going to go work with a bunch of engineers. They're probably going to not like working with an egghead. So I was a little bit uncomfortable with the PhD part of my name. So when I came down here, I did not really want to advertise that. Unfortunately, at the introductory meeting where my new boss was introducing me to all my new coworkers, she had left the resume on the table, and one of the guys that was in the room, who later became one of my good friends, picked it up, looked at it, and said, "Ah, we got an egghead here. Welcome aboard, Dr. Bob." And so much for trying to be under the radar, and it stuck. So that's what everyone knows me as.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. I share your angst, because I actually worked at Bobo for a while. Before I was a doctor, I was an egghead doctor. Before I was a medical doctor, I was an egghead doctor. I've gone through several different lives. And as an egghead doctor, I went to work for Mobil. Actually, I went to work for Exxon and then for Mobil before they were one and the same. And I realized that egghead docs are nothing. Engineers are God. So I guess it's the same at NASA.
Yeah, it's an interesting environment. And I like actually bringing in both aspects of working as kind of an engineer, but as a scientist. My scientist friends say I don't really think like an engineer, and my engineer friends say I don't really think like a scientist, and I take that as a compliment.
I think so. Well, since we're talking about you and NASA, tell us one of your stories about being a flight director. I mean, we've seen Apollo 13. So what's happened on your watch?
Well, when you hold the lives of three people and over $100 billion worth of hardware in your hands, I have learned that it's best to start your day with a double espresso. And I'm going to tell you about one of those days. Now, as a flight director, we go through a great deal of training, simulations, and working with the flight controllers and the astronauts to practice failures and problem solving. But even with all that training, there are times when you lay awake at night and worry about what will happen on that day when something major goes wrong on your shift and you have to make one of those tough decisions. So it was the morning of March 13, 2009, when I came to start my shift. And literally, as the off-going flight director was going out the door, he mentioned to me that they had been tracking some space debris, but he really didn't think it was going to be a problem. Unfortunately, shortly on my shift, my trajectory officer, who tracks that kind of debris, reported that they had new observations, and he said that there was a small but non-zero chance that it could hit the space station. Now, there's over 500,000 pieces of debris orbiting the Earth at tens of thousands of miles per hour, and these are pieces from old rocket bodies and long-dead satellites, but they all risk hitting the space station. And to give you an idea, something, say, about the size of a silver dollar, if it hit the space station, which itself is going about 17,500 miles per hour, the impact would be like a stick of dynamite going off, and it would blow a big hole in the side of the space station. And in about 12 seconds, the oxygen would be so low that the crew would lose consciousness and die soon after that. So you may not have realized it, but it was my colleagues, my flight controllers and flight directors, and I who were squirming very uncomfortably in their seats during the movie Gravity, because that is our worst case scenario and the type of stuff that keeps us up at night. So after he informed me of this, we also realized that we didn't have time to calculate a maneuver and get out of the way from the debris. And it was times like this that I really wish I was in control of the Millennium Falcon and could tell my flight control team to punch at Chewie and get us out of here. But that wasn't an option. So the team and I, we started talking what options we could come up with. And after a little bit of discussion, we decided to have the crew shelter in space in the Soyuz. Now, the Soyuz is the Volkswagen-size Russian vehicle that the spacecraft that took the astronauts to the space station and would take them home at the end of their six-month stay. And it stayed docked at the far end of the Russian segment, part of the International Space Station, and served as a lifeboat in an emergency. And we concluded that if the space station was hit, there was a chance that if they were sheltering in the Soyuz, that they could hopefully undock and come home safely. Now, getting into the Soyuz and staying there is not like hiding in your closet during a tornado warning. You have to turn on the life support systems and power systems to turn on the life support systems and the computers to turn on the power systems, so it's a bit involved. Now, we also decided to take some other steps to prepare the space station in case it got hit. For example, we decided to take the solar arrays, which are about the length of a football field, and there's four of them on the space station, and turn them edge on into the field, the path of the oncoming debris, kind of minimizing its cross-section and hopefully reducing the chance of the arrays being hit. But when you park them this way so that they're not tracking the sun, you reduce the power that's generated, which means you have to start shutting down equipment, which basically means, for non-critical stuff, the science payloads. The other thing we decided to do was to close the roughly dozen hatches in between the modules and lock them down. And the reason for this was that if one of the modules got hit, while it might deflate or go to vacuum, the hope was that it would be only that one module and the space station would be able to survive. We also decided to have a few cameras turned on so that if the crew, you know, couldn't see what was going on or had to leave, we could maybe see what was going on inside the space station. But all these activities meant that we weren't going to be doing any research that day because the astronauts would be getting ready to get safe and we would be powering down stuff. So I decided to take 30 seconds and call my boss just to give him a heads up. I didn't want him to get surprised by his boss calling him and saying, "Hey, what's going on? What the hell is your flight director doing in there? Because we need to be doing science." So after I did that, my next big challenge was to actually convince the Russians to do this. It's their Soyuz, after all, so we had to get them to agree. Plus, they tend to believe in what's called the Big Sky Theory, even though there has been a few cases where some satellites have actually collided in space, and that's one of the reasons we have so much debris up there. Now, convincing them is not like we're doing here where I could sit and just tell you what I want to do. I have to speak in kind of short, simple phrases that then get translated into Russian. They then have to discuss it among themselves to decide if they want to agree or not. They've got to then say it back to me, which then has to get translated in English. So it's a very time-consuming process, and we didn't have a whole lot of time. And fortunately, politics is part of my job. This is an international project, and after some negotiation, the Russian flight director agreed to the plan. So at that point, we called up the astronauts, told them what we were thinking. They listened intently. They knew that we had their back and decided to, you know, they just went ahead and started doing all the activities that we asked them to do. So they did that. They closed the hatches, turned on the cameras, we configured the solar arrays, they got into the Soyuz and got ready. And then, and Apollo 13 is a good example of this, more times than not, you know, you sit there and you wait. And I watched my flight control team to see signs of an impact. Alarms going off, systems failing, the space station tumbling out of control. And we waited, and after the time of closest approach, as we call it, my trajectory officer signaled that it had passed, and obviously it had not hit the space station. So we were lucky that day. That was the first time we'd done that, but we created a procedure that unfortunately we've had to use a number of times, and in fact, just this past weekend, we thought we were going to have to do it again because some debris came by, but in the last time it was able to be detected as not being a threat. So after we were doing all this and we called the crew up and said, "Hey, everything's safe. You can back out of closing the hatches and the Soyuz and we will try to resume our operations." I've been very focused for those several hours, as we do, of just working the problem, trying to figure out what every risk I had to deal with, coming up with a decision, figuring out the best way to go forward. Excuse me. And for the first time, I turned around, and behind the flight director console in Mission Control is a big glassed-in auditorium where visitors and VIPs can come in and watch what's going on in Mission Control. And I looked up there, and I realized that my boss was sitting there. And in fact, his boss and all the bosses, all the managers, were up there. And for a second, my breath caught and my knees buckled, because I didn't realize that. And if I'd known that they were all sitting there, the pressure that would have exposed me to is something that we never trained with in all those simulations. But I did notice that my boss was giving me a thumbs up, and I realized that he unconditionally supported my decision and knew that it was the right thing, that even though we didn't get some science done that day, you know, we were thinking about keeping the astronauts alive and making sure that we were doing the best thing we could.
Bob, that's an amazing story. And I think that from day to day, we've gotten used to having astronauts on the International Space Station. And, you know, I can't remember when the last one went up and when the last one came down. And we're not getting news bulletins about possible near misses. And yet these things are happening in your life. So 24 hours a day, I guess there is a flight director 24/7 who is managing the mission.
That's correct. Now, we've had people on the International Space Station for 17 years now continuously. And we run 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And in fact, on Monday, three astronauts that had been up there for 6 months safely returned in their Soyuz over in Kazakhstan. And later this month, we will launch three more astronauts that will be up there for 6 months. So there are continuously about six people there full time.
And there are six people from how many different countries?
The major partners are Japan, Russia, United States, Canada, and then the European Space Agency, which is a consortium of a number of countries, Germany, France, Italy, England, and so forth.
Now, back to the story about the debris. About how often do you encounter something that makes you have to stop what you're doing and launch into another mode, just a totally another, because that to me is what this was. You're getting up, you're about to do your science, and now all of a sudden you're ready to avert disaster if it happens.
Yes, the space station itself has some shields on it for small pieces of debris that routinely hit it. Unfortunately, if we can track it, that pretty much would mean that it would destroy the space station. And we're tracking a lot of pieces of debris, and it's not uncommon to, I would say, about half a dozen times a year, we actually perform a maneuver to get out of the way of the debris. And then there's the few times a year where we either find out about the debris too last minute to do something like that, and we shelter in place. But there's a lot of days that we are monitoring debris and trying to see if it's going to be a risk. And that gets to be a challenge, because if you do a maneuver, it affects when, for example, the next astronauts, when they're going up to the space station, if you have to raise the orbit of the space station, their orbit and trajectory to get there is now different, and they might not be able to launch if you don't do it right. So it's not something you just want to do, and it requires a lot of complicated calculations, and it affects the mission that's going on. So pretty much, I would say at least once a week, we're fretting over that sort of stuff. And hopefully, most of the time, it's just fretting and nothing more.
Oh, so I have to say, one of the books I've read, Mary Doria Russell wrote The Sparrow and the sequel, Children of God. And in one of their space flights, a very small piece of debris hits their rocket and wreaks all kinds of havoc. I'm just putting, I mean, the rocket goes tumbling. They have to shut off different parts of it. And I remember reading that thinking, huh, can this really happen? And now I've heard this story from you. Yes, can really happen and has really affected our astronauts. That's quite impressive. Bob, You told me recently that you're writing a book about being a flight director. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That's correct. Several of my flight director colleagues and I realized a few years ago that there really wasn't a good book on operating the International Space Station. Various astronauts have written some books about their time in space. The original flight directors, Chris Kraft and Gene Kranz, have written some books about what it was like being a flight director for the Apollo program. But we didn't really have a good book that kind of talked about what is it like to operate the space station from day to day, whether it be doing a debris avoidance maneuver like I was just talking about, or planning and executing a spacewalk, or as visiting vehicles come up that bring up cargo or astronauts that we're always kind of, you know, that's coming and going. It's a little bit like an airport with things coming and going. And all these activities are constantly going on, and there's a team of men and women that are working 24 hours a day all year long making this happen. And we have a saying in Mission Control, don't make the news. And that's partly because if you make the news, it either means something went wrong or you made a mistake, and you don't really want to do either of those. So a lot of it goes off very quietly that you don't realize. If we're lucky, you know, you might get a 30-second snippet on the evening news of a launch of a crew or a vehicle or something like that. But there's a lot of work that's going on there, and there's a lot of devoted people that literally we lay in bed at night staring at the ceiling trying to worry about what if this happens or what if that goes wrong or what have I forgotten to make it work.
That's pretty scary. But now that you've told us about this book, and I know it's about to be published, is there a little piece of it that you can read?
Sure. The working title of the book is The International Space Station, Operating an Outpost in the New Frontier. And the section I'd like to talk to you a little bit about, read you a few snippets from, is related to a mission where I was assigned the lead flight director in 2007. And, excuse me, this was the 32nd mission towards assembling the space station. It had to be taken up in a lot of small pieces and put together. And this was actually the 130th shuttle mission. And when I was assigned, we actually thought this was going to be the last mission. So I thought I was going to be leading the end of the shuttle program, but we actually had a few other missions after that, fortunately. And the events that I'm going to talk about took place over a 13-day time span in February 2010. And when I was assigned the mission, it really had just three basic objectives, was to launch and attach the Node 3 module. And NASA has very creative names for these modules, and it's just a one of the various modules that you attach like a Tinker toy. And you can think of it as a tin can about 22 feet in length, about 15 feet in diameter, and it weighs about 42,000 pounds. And this is where we were going to put all the exercise equipment, the bathroom that the astronauts use, and some of the life support equipment. Now, also on that node module was attached a cupola, which is, you can think of it as kind of a hemispherical shaped module, about 9 feet in diameter, weighing about 4,100 pounds. And along kind of the sides of it, it has six windows, and the top of it has a big 30-inch window. And this was going to be attached to the bottom of the Node 3 and hang out at the bottom of the space station. And the astronauts would use this to either see vehicles coming and going to the space station or to operate the big 75-foot-long robotic arm. And by looking out the window, they could see this directly. Now, when I was assigned to this mission, the cupola to fit in the shuttle cargo bay was attached to one of the ends of the Node 3 module. And during the mission, we had to come up with a very complicated plan to attach the power and cooling system so that we could turn on the Node 3 module so that we could run the motors that move the bolts that held the cupola onto the Node 3 module, and after the robotic arm moved it to the bottom of the Node 3 where its permanent location was going to be, use the motors again to bolt it up. So we had to get the power system going, activate the Node 3. And one other thing I'll mention before I get into the story is that the cupola and the Node 3 were the only modules in all the assembly of the space station where they were mounted together on the Earth and not in space, and then had to be taken apart, and that's kind of important. And then the last thing I'll mention, when we were moving the cupola, like I said, you can kind of think of it as almost like a little like a teacup with computers and stuff in it and the windows, and we needed to have a thermal cover that we needed to put in there so that as we moved it, the computers and the equipment in there wouldn't get too hot or too cold.
So just to simplify this for a minute, in the space shuttle, Node 3 and the cupola are linked together because that makes them fit in the space shuttle. Once you get up there, you have to take them apart and then reassemble them in a different geometry.
That's correct.
Okay. Ready to read?
I am. And to set the stage, this is several days into the mission. The training and hard work of numerous people planning the move of the cupola on the space station over the last 3 years was paying off. The first significant issues with the intricate ballet of module movements came when the crew ingressed the cupola on day 6 of the mission to ready it for relocation. The crew went in and installed a protective cover over the cupola to thermally shield it during the operation. When crew members installed the cover, they noted that the clearance between the cover and some brackets was too small. A thin metal ruler barely fit between the bracket and the insulation. If the clearances were too tight, the cupola could not be mated in its new position. The specially trained contingency teams roared to life to analyze the problem. They considered different options. Could they do the move without the cover? What was the expected clearance on the port where it would be mated, since the modules had never actually been physically mated together in the final configuration on the Earth? Would the motors have enough force to bend the brackets without damaging the structure if there was interference? The root of the problem quickly became apparent, though. To save file size, the computer models did not include bolts, since thousands of bolts added megabytes to each drawing. What seemed like a small issue became a significant wrinkle. After a number of meetings around the clock, the teams decided that there would be barely enough clearance for the cupola to fit. If enough clearance did not exist, it was likely some of the brackets would bend, but nothing would break. This, however, was considered unlikely. The teams pressed ahead toward the relocation. Another spacewalk for preparation, and the Node 3 module, to which the cupola was to be mated, was activated for the first time using half of the power and cooling systems. After the activation, one of the key controllers for the mating of the bolts for the Node 3 module failed into a diagnostic safe mode. While the flight control team tried to quickly interpret the cause, the flight director ensured the team didn't get too far behind on the timeline and that the most critical objectives could still be accomplished. After a power cycle, things were operating again and preparations for the mating could continue. Flight day 8 arrived, and it was time to relocate the cupola. Problems in the system of bolts used to fasten modules together rarely occurred on orbit, so it came as a bit of a surprise when in mission control we saw that one of the bolts had jammed while trying to detach the cupola. After quick discussions with the engineering team, we decided to force the bolt to push harder. The bolt released, but a second one jammed, and then a third. This scenario was completely unexpected. The ground team had to stop to assess the situation and to avoid damage to the hardware. However, it was like having an automobile tire half off, and not a good place to be in the long term. In real time, the team deduced that gravity caused the bolts to tighten unevenly during installation at the Kennedy Space Center, unlike previous modules that were bolted together exclusively on orbit. Therefore, the forces on the bolt would be uneven as the cupola was being demated. This is analogous to removing the adjacent lug nuts rather than the opposing nuts while changing a tire. As in a simulation, Flight control methodically nudged and tweaked the bolts. Soon, the cupola was free and moving to the node. The clearances were fine, the computers continued to operate, and the system of bolts worked smoothly as the cupola was firmly mated to the bottom of node 3. Since things were now running smoothly, the Space Shuttle Program and International Space Station Program teams agreed to use the extra mission day for the life support rack transfers that were a part of this move. On the eighth day of the mission, the crew was like an army of ants, removing bolts that would hold things in place during the tremendous vibrations during launch, removing items stowed in Node 3, moving the life support racks and exercise equipment into place, and trying to secure all the elements. It was slow work. Each rack was shut down and carefully moved to the new location. The flight control team then powered the system back up. Every rack experienced some small hiccup during the relocation. A cable not connected properly, the software not exactly as it had been tested on the ground, air bubbles in the plumbing. And the teams had to work through each issue. There was so much going on that two front room flight controllers were required to work just the various rack activities. The flight director had to ensure that the teams were synchronized as everyone worked in completing the critical activities on the timeline, with ongoing deferring and replanning each move, not to mention working with the engineering support team and the Europeans on the various other working issues. The role of the flight director is not unlike that of a Chinese acrobat who balances several spinning plates on poles. Every shift presents a new wrinkle, such as when the lead extravehicular activities officer, and for the audience, that's the guy in the charge of the spacewalks, came down with food poisoning and had to go home for a while, creating yet one more issue for the flight director to balance and work through. Due to the length of the mission and the intense work being performed to that point, part of the ninth day of the flight was crew time off. At this time, the crew members were able to rest and enjoy some spectacular views from the cupola. But first, as soon as the crew members awoke, they had a link up with the president. After a brief period of rest, the crew began preparing for the final spacewalk, which would take place the next day. As quickly as the storm of activity began, the mission started to wind down. Although not every task was complete, it was time for the crew of Endeavour to undock and return home. Far more had been accomplished than had been planned for even a year prior to the mission. Endeavour undocked on February 20th and flew around the station. Photos were taken of the newly installed module. The space station crew took a much-needed break and then completed the outfitting of Node 3 and the cupola over the next few weeks. On February 21st, 2010, Endeavour made a flawless nighttime landing at the Kennedy Space Center.
That's a nice, interesting to a story that reminds me of something akin to a very complicated tapestry coming together with threads of different colors from all over within a pattern, and some higher-level person knows what the final pattern is bringing in, okay, now bring in these strands of red, now bring in these strands of blue, now you get to weave in until you finally have the picture there.
That's actually an excellent analogy. I mean, and we spent 3 years planning bringing those threads in, and as you heard, and the book actually goes into a little more detail, like even on a rug, you get some snags, and that's what we have to work through. And that's what we do as flight controllers and flight directors. When things go well, it can actually be a little bit tedious on console, but it's the constant problems that crop up and the changes and the challenges that keep us busy and that we're constantly working through.
And it sounds like, at least in this case, if not in all cases, there were many changes and challenges. I love this piece of there were no bolts in the diagram because that was just too many megabytes to add to the drawing, so we just left those out. I mean, who needs to have the bolt? We know they're there.
That's true. And, you know, I never could have predicted that one. And it's the type of thing, you know, when, like I mentioned earlier, we lay awake at night worrying about what have we forgotten, and we try to plan for every possible contingency. But no matter how smart you are and how much you plan for, something like that that you could not have anticipated happens. And that's why our training that we go through really helps us, because you don't always know what the problem is going to be, but you've developed a way to think about it, a way to approach it. And it may sound a little corny, but we really do believe in this in mission control. Failure is not an option, and we're constantly working to make sure that that doesn't happen.
And I guess that was the famous Gene Kranz who's credited with that. Now, in your story, you keep talking about node 3. Are there just numbered nodes and everybody knows, hey, meet you in node 2 tonight? Nah, how about we do node 3?
Yes. At NASA, of course, while we're great as engineers, we're not the best as artists. So we tend to have very pedantic functional names. The laboratory module, for example, is where the main laboratory stuff occurs. The nodes represent modules that where kind of like a node, you can attach other modules to it. And so node 3 is what we kind of call it. Now, NASA does like to come up with names that are more user-friendly that the public will refer to. So one of the things that happened during the planning ramping up to this mission is NASA decided to, instead of just picking a name for Node 3, they decided to make it a contest so that the public could vote what they thought was the best name. Now, it turned out that a big fan of NASA is Stephen Colbert. And he loved this idea and took it on his show and ran with it and really made it well known to his fans. And sure enough, it got the most votes to name the module Colbert. Now, NASA as a government entity can't name a piece of hardware or laboratory like that after a person. So they actually chose the name Tranquility. But we really did appreciate what Colbert did. I mean, he was enthusiastic and he actually got a lot of people interested. So one of the new pieces of equipment that was moved into the Node 3 was a treadmill that the astronauts used to exercise on every day. And it was given the name of Combined Operational Load-Bearing External Resistance Treadmill, or Colbert for short.
So you're going to go down to the Colbert in Tranquility.
That is true. That is true. And there's been a couple times where we've had to fix Colbert, but it's actually working very well.
Well, next time I watch Stephen Colbert, I'm going to have a whole new appreciation for him, because I am a big fan of science. And I will actually be out there on April 22nd marching for Attention for Science.
So, I will too.
Oh, good. Hey, I'll see you there.
Yep.
All right. So I do want to say that here we are, a session, a radio program about storytellers, and we like to have a little tip for the storyteller. And so I think this is a wonderful time to talk about just what a story is. A story needs to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Tonight we've had a guest who's a champion storyteller. Actually, he was a champion and his first foray into the moth. And if you listen to his stories, they each had a beginning, a middle, and an end. Many of us have life experiences that we share in bits and pieces. I know I do it. I have anecdotes that turn into something funny, and it makes me the life of the party. But that's not telling a story. So to make them into a story, it needs to be organized into those three parts. The beginning is the part that grabs the audience's interest. Start with a theme. Express it as it fits your story. Your story fills in the middle. The end is the result, and it can be anything. And I'm going to give you a one-minute story. I was born with a yearning to be heard somewhere, somehow. I entered the storytelling arena with some personal stories and met the co-hosts of So What's Your Story on KPFT, and now I am a co-host of So What's Your Story on KPFT. So there it is, guys, in one sentence, my story. And I challenge you, our listeners, to wake up tomorrow morning and have a story to tell. Just put it all together. So, Dr. Bob, I always like to give my guests a chance to say goodnight to Radioland. I want to say goodnight to anybody in particular or all.
Well, what I would like to say is I definitely have to thank my wife, who has helped me become a good and better flight director and has helped bring the storyteller out of me. And, you know, one thing I like about my job is it's always interesting and changing, and I think there's a lot of stories there.
You know, and we've heard a lot of stories tonight. We heard one about an injury, a brain injury, that turned into a life-changing event. We heard another about day-to-day, some of the emergencies that happen on the space station and the readiness. I mean, when I think of these guys going over to the Soyuz, they might have actually have had to detach and make their way home. And then finally, a story of attaching the cupola, which was a dance between one complexity and another, unanticipated. So that's been very exciting. Oh, and if you don't mind, you want to say goodnight to the astronauts, even though they're asleep. Maybe they can hear it on the radio pod.
Yes. So I'd like to say goodnight to the Expedition 51 crew and hope they're having a good day tomorrow.
Okay. So Brian and Jason are next with To Tell the World, another class act on KPFT. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, hey, sitting on your computer or with your smartphone, kpft.org, live streaming, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving a great story, and we'll keep bringing them to you. Thanks, Dr. Bob, for joining us, and thank you for your stories. Happy Passover, happy Easter, and happy spring to all of us. Greg, Warren, Hank, Nalal, Nicole, Alondra, Lisa, and I will forever be reminding you it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
An ex-athlete is waiting to be welcomed into a loving home. There's a greater need to place ex-racing greyhounds into permanent homes than at any point in recent history. As a result of greyhound racetrack closings across the country, April is National Adopt a Greyhound Month and the perfect time to adopt a gentle companion into your home. Thousands of greyhounds are being cared for by adoption groups now. Please help ensure that all these wonderful dogs find homes by visiting thegreyhoundproject.org for information on adoption in your area. KPFT Houston. KPFT wrapped up its spring fun drive on April 12th. Thanks to all who contributed. Your support keeps independent music, news, and ideas on the air. Although KPFT received many generous financial contributions during this spring campaign, your local community radio station remains a bit short of its financial goal. If you value the unique voices found on Houston's Radio for Peace, contribute at kpft.org or text your donation to KPFT to 41444. As Pacifica Radio's founder Lewis Hill stated, as long as I can communicate, I can create. As long as I can create, I am free. Help us keep free speech and resistance radio alive today and for future generations. This is KPFT Houston.
Hello and welcome to another installment of Tell the World. My name is Jason.
My name is Sean.
Brian is not actually going to be with us tonight, so we are just going to be the two musketeers. Thank you for joining us for this hour. Brian is probably listening, gritting his teeth right now. No, not really. He has something important to do. We're going to try to carry on without him. I think we'll be okay.
Yeah, no, we'll be fine. We did the work.
You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. And by the way, you know, we finished our fun drive a little earlier today. It ended at 6. We had some great people calling in the last couple weeks. I just want to let you know, if you missed your opportunity, if you still want to support KPFT, you can always go to kpft.org. There's a donate now button. We do accept your money throughout the year, by the way, in case you were wondering. So that's always an option. We'd love to have your support on this community radio station that is built by you.
Right, and there's always the offer on tote bags and T-shirts, and that doesn't quite go away, so that's still on the table.
You can still find those things. Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's jump into it. It has been a busy week. Since our last show, the world has been a busy place. Last week, we talked about the deadly, the latest deadly attack on civilians in Syria, where war has been raging for 6 years. That's as long, by the way, as the Second World War went on in Europe. That is a long time for a war. Syria's government forces, under the leadership of Bashar al-Assad, allegedly carried out a chemical attack in the city of Idlib that killed scores of civilians, many of whom were young children. Last week, we also talked about the White House's immediate response to the attack, which was basically Donald Trump blaming the Obama administration for the chemical attack. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, in his own statement, pointed blame towards Russia and Iran. Sean Spicer told reporters that there was, quote, no fundamental option of regime change as a response to the Syrian attack. After our show, things took a drastic turn. Last Thursday, the United States carried out a surprise missile attack against the Syrian airbase, which had allegedly sent the bombers to Idlib, launching nearly 60 missiles from warship stationed in the Mediterranean. Later the same day, Tillerson said the attack didn't represent a change in U.S. policy in Syria, even though it very clearly did just that. The U.S. had never before directly engaged the Syrian government forces. We had never before participated in the civil war. The message from all levels of the Trump administration was basically the same. This is not the beginning of a campaign to remove Assad. The attack was appropriate, proportional. It was just a response. A one-off, if you will. Well, things change fast and have taken another drastic turn. Although the president hasn't made a public statement until today on Syria since that counterattack, the administration's policy seems to have been shifting dramatically in that time. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, in a CNN interview last weekend, said that removing Syrian President Bashar al-Assad from power is a priority. That alone is a massive change, a dramatic departure from both Trump's known personal opinion that he tweets often and did all the way back to 2013, and also his administration stance. President Donald Trump, before his election, described fighting ISIS and seeking Assad's removal at the same time as idiocy. Well, on Monday, Press Secretary Sean Spicer told reporters that the U.S. would respond if the Assad regime used barrel bombs against his own people, which is something that has already happened several times over the last 6 years. After that press conference, his aides clarified that this didn't signal a change in administration policy, even though it very apparently did. Now, Russia claims the Syrian regime is being unfairly blamed for the chemical attack, and Putin said the attack was simply staging and a provocation. Putin suggested on Monday that forces within Syria were plotting more chemical attacks, including near Damascus, which is the capital, and that they intended to pin those attacks on the Syrian government regime. Washington has said in response that Russia and Syria are trying to, quote, confuse the world community about who is responsible for using chemical weapons against the Syrian people in this and earlier attacks. Now, just after the attack, Russia's story was that the Syrian bombers had hit a warehouse containing a rebel weapon stockpile, which included chemical gas, but now it seems they're suggesting the rebels are intentionally planning false flag attacks to gain support from foreign nations in the civil war. Russia seems to suggest that the bombing in Idlib was actually one of these attacks. So, the Syrian attack, the complicated American and Russian responses were a dramatic lead-up to Secretary of State Rex Tillerson attending a G7 meeting yesterday in Italy. During this meeting, a British proposal to impose new sanctions on Syria and Russia failed to pass. The intention was to give Tillerson some negotiating power with Russia, but the foreign ministers attending the G7 meeting failed to reach a consensus on the measure and decided to wait for the outcome of an international investigation. Tillerson flew to Moscow right after the meeting with no bargaining chip, after having directly attacked Russia's primary ally. Syria is the number one ally for Russia. Now, if you thought it wasn't a big deal that he was a CEO with no diplomatic experience when he was appointed, you might feel differently now. Tillerson Lavrov, who is the foreign minister for Russia, had a two-hour meeting today before a press conference, and here's what we learned at the press conference. Lavrov said there needs to be an honest investigation of the chemical attack, and he also noted that there are deep-rooted issues between the U.S. and Russia, but great potential to work together. Secretary of State Tillerson agreed, and he also told Putin that U.S.-Russia relations are at a low point, and he pointed out that the situation in Ukraine and Crimea was still a barrier to a better relationship. Now, the pair also, a little side note, briefly talked about the possibility that Russia hacked the U.S. election in some way. With Russia's foreign minister just sitting inches away from him, Tillerson said it's fairly well established that Russia was involved in the hacking of the U.S. election campaign. Tillerson said, it's a serious issue, it's one that we know, and Lavrov replied, not a single fact has been confirmed. So we're not doing a very good job agreeing on anything today. Also today, and it's just been one thing after another after another, the UN held a vote on a resolution drafted by the US, UK, and France to investigate this chemical attack. The resolution called for Syria to provide such information as flight logs and manifests. And remember earlier, I said Lavrov said there needs to be an honest investigation. Well, Russia vetoed the resolution. That means if an international investigation takes place, Syria and Russia will not willingly participate. This is the eighth time that Russia has vetoed a vote on a Syrian resolution. Now, it's not the only crazy world event. We're going to get into a discussion, but Sean.
Right. Okay. So once again, on the other side of the world, Chinese news outlets are reporting today that the Tomahawk missile strike in Syria was meant to serve an additional purpose in intimidating North Korea. This comes out at a time when Japanese warships are meeting up with the USS Carl Vinson in the U.S. Navy in the East China Sea, as we all wait to see what will soon be, according to satellite data, North Korea's sixth test regarding their nuclear capability and long-range missiles. So, also, today there was a rumor floating around that China was amassing 150,000 troops on their border with North Korea. Pentagon officials, in so many words, according to NBC, say that this is not true. However, at any one time, a quarter of a million Chinese troops are present in northeast China. So as you recall, last week at Mar-a-Lago, the president of the United States and China were reported to have talked at length about the Democratic People's Republic of Korea and the threat that it poses to all parties present. However, China's position is said to be that they, quote, do not believe that the conditions are right today to engage in discussions with the government in Pyongyang, end quote, which is unfortunate. Because North Korea news outlets are telling citizens of the DPRK that with the U.S. picking on countries without nuclear weapons, such as Syria, now more than ever, the people of North Korea must have faith in the military to save them against a violent superpower like us. So China at this time is not in the mood for peace talks. North Korea is preparing another missile to fire. The U.S. and Japan have an increased military presence in the region. Any more U.N. sanctions to North Korea would just continue to hurt the people at the bottom of Korean society, which is being led by North Korea's favorite son, who at this time may not have have the ability to act as diplomatically with the West as his father did.
Yeah, well,
which is a weird statement to say that, you know,
right,
Kim Jong-il was a diplomat versus Kim Jong-un.
Yes, and his father never reached out to murder his own brother in another country with a chemical attack like Kim Jong-un.
Right, and
he was like
the nicest brother. Like, I felt really bad. Like, that's the brother that, like, wanted to, like, go to Disneyland in Japan, and they just, like, no, you go to Hong Kong,
right,
and just be drunk and gamble. And, like, that was what they did with him. I was like, he was my favorite oldest son,
yeah.
And that was a really tragic story.
There's usually not a lot of possibility in North Korea for regime change that's not completely planned, but people did like this guy. They thought, well, if something ever happened...
Right, there's always the nice brother, but now he's gone. Smaller editorial to this, we got to this point, I think, the seeming brink of another Korean War, because how we thought and we talked about North Korean regime, we have always held them as a silly, weak military power that tries to make long-range missiles, but at the same time, they're evil pink okamis. this is propaganda language, and a lot of us are falling for it. Kim Jong-un is seen as a, quote, crazy fat boy, to quote Senator McCain, who just wants to play with nuclear weapons like some kind of man-child. This isn't true. This isn't a realistic look at how North Korea is run. He is a leader of a regime that remains in power in the face of really harsh sanctions and conditions by steadily increasing military strength to the point where now he basically has to do something with it. We now have a serious... He can now do serious damage to neighboring Asian nations and to the U.S. Yeah. So the next time you see... if this happens again. We did it with Germany. You know, we do this thing where we depict someone, a foreign power, as stupid or weak or evil or all of them at the same time. Be careful, because this means that someone somewhere is just trying to justify that they think there's a war that is easy to win, and those don't exist anymore.
No. I mean, I'm not sure that those have existed since Vietnam.
Right.
And we learned that lesson the hard way. All right. So let's talk about a little bit of this. Syria, North Korea, this is all kind of one big world political drama mess, ball of yarn. Let's see if we can untangle it a little. Let's talk about the U.S. retaliatory attack in the context of some of our favorite things, Donald Trump's tweets. So in August 2013...
I hear Brian's eyes rolling just like somewhere spiritually.
I won't do any impressions.
Okay.
In August 2013, Trump tweeted, "The president must get congressional approval before attacking Syria. Big mistake if he does not." Okay, so wait a minute. Should Trump have gotten congressional approval before attacking Syria? Was this, in fact, a big mistake, we think?
So this goes into, like, how much executive power versus how much, you know, versus over the military as commander-in-chief versus, like, obviously Congress is about to declare war, but we've given everybody a wide berth ever since George W. Bush and Barack Obama to attack people who, I forget the exact language, but people, Al-Qaeda and ISIS have also kind of like branched off of that idea from Al-Qaeda. People who intend us harm, but they're not nations. And so
right.
we have the ability to go and attack them somewhat, you know, legally within our system.
Mm-hmm.
But Syria is fighting Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Mm-hmm. But like, then again, we attack Syria, which is a nation. And so it's very, like, it's a whole... I mean, the New York Times said that the Trump doctrine is the fall of no doctrine. Like, this is well and far and above, like, the war, like, what war powers were supposed to be expected when we wrote him back in 73. This
right.
is very surprising to me.
Well, and especially when you consider that, you know, this is the primary ally of Russia. Let's not mince words. This is like if somebody attacked the UK, mm-hmm. attacked France, which even though France gets a bad rap for some reason, they are our oldest ally, this nation's oldest ally. It would be like someone attacking one of those countries, Germany, Japan, Canada, and for the United States to expect the United States to not react. This is a big deal. And not only that, Russia is a nuclear power, mm-hmm. And one that, you know, actually I think at last count has more nuclear weapons than us, although it's enough to melt the world anyway, so who's counting? But Iran is also a nuclear capable country, North Korea, and they are loosely allied with Russia as well. North Korea less so, but even still. This is hugely different than attacking Syria, attacking Al-Qaeda. Goodness. So congressional approval, it definitely before anything else happens. I don't know what else could happen at this point. Russia has very icily said, don't do it again, don't do anything else. We're just going to have to see what happens with Tillerson in Russia.
Right, yeah. And then again, like that, they said they will no longer coordinate with us, which then puts us at increased risk if we do additional remote military actions, such as, like, cruise missiles.
If we
hit Russians, it creates another extremely big conundrum.
Yeah.
Not
only that, it was a big deal. It was a huge olive branch to even have us exchanging that information in the first place. That was our two militaries speaking together so we didn't accidentally blow each other up.
And the relationship between those two militaries has been icy in general. We used to do, like, joint military actions with each other and practices and stuff, and we stopped doing that a while ago.
Yeah. All right, well, just because, here are some of Donald Trump's other tweets on Syria from 2013. Here's one. Remember, all these, quote, freedom fighters in Syria want to fly planes into our buildings. And that's in reference to the Syrian rebels. Mm-hmm. We should stay the hell out of Syria. The, quote, rebels are just as bad as the current regime. And then all in caps, what will we get for our lives and billions? Zero. The only reason President Obama wants to attack Syria is to save face over his very dumb red line statement. Do not attack Syria, fix USA.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, like, it seems like maybe the Trump rule is to do exactly the opposite of what President Obama did. Which is interesting because, like, President Obama did try to go to Congress and then he didn't get any approval for it. And there's two ways to do that. Maybe he was acting correctly as far as like dealing with foreign powers and military. Maybe he was just trying to CYA or cover his butt. And as he proceeded forward, yada yada yada. It's just the bizarro policy. It's just do the exact opposite, and that is the correct answer.
Well, here's one tweet that he didn't go back on. It was, why do we keep broadcasting when we are going to attack Syria? Why can't we just be quiet and, if we attack at all, catch them by surprise?
Right.
Well, I guess we can
do that.
A popular idea with conservative media during Trump's campaign was that he was a great negotiator, but Clinton's policies would get us into World War III. Even Jill Stein said on a Pacifica station, if I remember correctly, that Hillary Clinton's proposal for no-fly zones in Syria would start World War III. So now the U.S. has shot missiles at the primary ally of Russia. Altogether, like we said, this alliance includes Iran, even North Korea to some extent, all countries with nuclear capabilities. The day of the retaliatory attack, conservative radio host Laura Ingraham, you remember Laura Ingraham, she was being considered for a cabinet position in the Trump administration, actually, big conservative radio voice. She tweeted, missiles flying, Rubio's happy, McCain ecstatic, Hillary's on board, a complete policy change in 48 hours. Well, not the first one either.
Right.
Even Richard Spencer, the guy that was Nazi saluting and saying Heil Trump, the guy who got punched in the face on live TV and everybody kind of cheered it. He's having his doubts about Donald Trump now. The guy who said Heil Trump.
I didn't hear about that until I read it from you. It's pretty ridiculous.
He put out I guess it was a YouTube video or whatever he is on, basically talking about how he's lost faith in Donald Trump for not doing the alt-right nationalist thing, not ignoring what's going on in the world. There has been this opinion with the alt-right and right-wing populists that we shouldn't be policing the world. We should be focusing on ourselves and the whole infrastructure and the wall. And everything you talked about during the campaign is gone. And they're starting to realize, or they're starting to say and tweet that, oh, we elected a secret neocon.
Right.
Great. More of the same.
Right.
So I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see how much. Now, he had a 35% approval rating before he attacked Syria. I don't know when they're going to pull that again.
I heard, I was reading the 538 podcast.
Oh, and Nate Silver?
Yeah, went from 40 to, 43 this week after the Syria thing.
Mm.
But, usually, there's a misconception that, after some kind of military action, your approval goes up, which isn't always true necessarily. Then again, you got to remember whose support did you get out of attacking Syria? It's a very weird group because as we're going to talk about, just like the healthcare bill, the Republican camp, a lot of them have come forward and said that they support it. Some of them, but then the other ones, the more populist people are can't support it. And then the Democrats have to support it. But at the same point, they're cautiously doing so because they had to be contrarian to the Trump administration. So, it's I don't know.
Well, let's talk about the political left in response to this. Now, the GOP, for the most part, has lined up behind Trump. You've even got John McCain and Lindsey Graham, who have been huge Trump
detractors?
Critics.
Yeah.
Critics, I'm sorry. They're even lining up behind him, supporting his retaliatory strike. But where are the Democrats? Well, for the most part, Democrats on the Hill have been cautiously supportive of the strike, because let's remember, Obama did go to Congress and ask for permission. This is something that Democrats have supported. They're not, coming out and saying, "Woo, Trump, big fan now, yeehaw," because that's not the way politics works in this country
right
now.
Because they were supportive of Obama doing it because Obama wanted to do it. So they're do you just go back and be contrarian?
Trump has pulled the rug out from everybody on this.
Yeah.
They don't know what to do. They might support the action, but they don't want to support the man. So you're seeing this really muted response. Many Democrats have said that the president does need to seek or should have already sought congressional approval. You might expect Democrats to be more vocally against this sort of thing, but that's American politics. But don't forget that Clinton has also called for action in Syria and specifically for bombing Assad's airfields. Now, this is neat.
Yeah.
In a weird turn of events, and if you're a conspiracy theorist, you're going to love this. Clinton was talking about Syria at a Women in the World summit in New York on Thursday. This was hours before the U.S. attack was carried out. She told the audience, quote, "I really believe that we should have and still should take out his airfields and prevent him from being able to use them to bomb innocent people and drop sarin gas on them. A couple hours later, Trump messed with his national security team, sat down for dinner with the Chinese president at Mar-a-Lago, and the strike occurred.
Right.
Weird.
Like, while the meeting's going on. So that was one of those weird things where the Mar-a-Lago meeting was going on, and we're all like, waiting and, you know, trying to figure out what would happen, because before this all happened, we were all talking about Trump's anti-China message, and what's it going to look like when he sits down with a president who needs to save face and show China that he can negotiate with the great negotiator.
Mm-hmm.
And then like the Syria attack happens, and it's like smokescreen, and it's like, every time we feel like we're about to catch a fish in Donald Trump's tank, he just scurries the sand around a little bit, and then we have to wait for it all settled before it's just, I know, it gets really hard to follow. And then at the same point, we have this like deteriorating Russia relationship at the same point where we're trying to figure out whether or not like Russia insidiously put this man in power.
Yes.
So like going on the conspiracy theories again, like even if Trump is the Manchurian candidate, like now he's going back and biting the hand that fed him. Like nothing, well, you know, every time we try to make sense of this, it stops making sense.
Well, I think to me, what makes the most sense is, you know, I do think there's definitely something to the investigations of Russia interfering with the election, but I don't necessarily think that if Donald Trump was in on it, I don't necessarily think that he was actively in on it I don't know. It's hard. I think that the Russians worked to get Donald Trump into power because Vladimir Putin hates Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. They hate the fact that she wanted to attack Russia. They loved what Donald Trump was saying. So, yes, Donald Trump, I think, personally, this isn't a news thing. This is just my opinion. Okay. Just want to put that out there.
Got it.
I think personally that they did help him get into power, but that he's not necessarily beholden to him. There's no spoken agreement between them. And I think the Russians are now starting to realize that they actually didn't put anti-Hillary in. They just put a loose cannon in who really doesn't have any political loyalty.
Right. Like, I think, like, it's we've shown and investigations have proven that there were, you know, like trolls hired by Russia to get on message boards.
Lots
and
of
obscure
them.
Everything. Yeah, like, it's a huge thing. And yeah, I think, like, it's very reasonable. Like, Hillary's policy in Crimea was not, you know, Putin didn't like that. And yeah, Hillary's policy regarding Syria, Putin didn't like that. So obviously, like, if you have the power to change that, then you just make it so that she doesn't win. And so I think even if it was, Greg Johnson? Even if it was him,
Gary Johnson.
Anyway, so yeah,
yeah,
that's what it sounds like.
By the way, you know, we talked about Democrats and Republican reactions. Libertarians are livid. By the way, if you care about that sort of thing, because libertarians also fall into that same camp of don't police the world,
right?
Stay here.
Well, libertarians also don't like driver's licenses. So like,
that's true. They just don't like that missiles they paid for were shot into another country. They want to keep those. All
right. Right.
All right. Moving off of Syria slightly.
only a smidge.
Only a little. Let's go to Hitler. Yeah. So, because why not? Because Sean Spicer did. So Sean Spicer has had a tough time being Trump's press secretary. From the very first day where Mr. Spicer falsely proclaimed that Trump's inauguration was the most attended, most watched around the world ever, period. With I'm kind of banging on the desk, but I think he banged on the podium. Mm-hmm. You know, his first ever appearance, okay, this guy's lying. Now, to just weeks ago, when he used dubious reporting by Fox News to try to back up Trump's wiretapping claims, he seems to have been straddling the line between bending the truth and flat-out lying. Yesterday, things got worse. For some reason, Spicer tried to illustrate just how horrible the Syrian chemical attacks were by saying that not even Hitler sank to using chemical weapons during World War II. Spicer was apparently trying to say, by the way, this is Passover right now. This week is Passover.
Right.
Throw that out there.
And okay. Also the,
in case you're unaware,
an anniversary of a concentration camp being liberated by U.S. forces.
There you go.
At the same time.
So Spicer was apparently trying to say that Germany didn't use chemical weapons against the Allied forces on the battlefield. What he actually said was completely ignorant to the fact that just like Assad, Hitler did, in fact, use chemical weapons on civilians. Now, primarily within concentration camps during the Holocaust, yes. Conservative news outlets had been making a similar comparison between Hitler and Assad earlier in the week. And we've heard before that when Trump's briefs Spicer, he often brings, you know, news stories, printouts, papers, and circles things he wants Spicer to talk about. This could, you know, it's probably just more evidence to that fact, more insight to where Trump gets his news. Regardless of how it started, people are wondering how it's going to end. Both yesterday and today, Spicer went on to news shows, CNN yesterday, NBC something today, to publicly apologize for minimizing the atrocities of Adolf Hitler during the Holocaust. But there have already been several calls for Spicer to be fired. Shortly after Spicer's statement, the Anne Frank Center released its own statement, categorizing the top White House staffer as a Holocaust denier, saying, quote, Trump must fire him at once. That was from Executive Director Stephen Goldstein at the Anne Frank Center. Esquire's Charles Pierce published an article calling for Spicer's termination. Its opening read, fire the man or let him resign. I don't care, but do it now. And veteran journalist Dan Rather said, quote, this line of rhetoric is so unhinged, so amateurish, so lacking in the context and perspective necessary for statesmanship and diplomacy that I do not see how Mr. Spicer can be allowed to continue in his current position. Well, I've been wondering the same thing for at least 2 months.
And that's a hard thing because, you know, you look at a press secretary and their entire job is like put out fires. But like, but then they inadvertently, I presume, hired a fire starter, hired an arsonist that just keeps on going around and like, you know, and puts his flaming foot in his mouth. But
says,
like,
no, I helped put the fires out. No, you made them worse. Right. Made them worse? Or did I make them better?
And it's one of those things where like he came forward and he apologized and like, and I think that matters, and he realized he made a mistake, and I think we like that all well and good, and I think that part is done, but like this is how press secretaries get fired. Like this, like it's not a job with a low turnaround. Like it very commonly you switch them out, and I'm surprised Spicer has the legs that he does, because it's been just one searing gaffe after another one.
Yeah, and you know, he seemed to be getting away with it more at first. You know, they kind of rode that Donald Trump and his administration rode that wave of populism into office, and they had higher approval ratings, and everybody was more on board with the, yeah, you know, he's telling the truth, the media's lying, you got to get it from Trump and Spicer kind of thing. But that's getting harder and harder and harder every single nail you pound into that coffin that is Sean Spicer's job as press secretary. All right. Well, speaking of people close to Trump, last August, and we talked about this on the show, a handwritten ledger surfaced in Ukraine with dollar amounts and dates next to the name of Paul Manafort, who was then Donald Trump's campaign chairman. I think he was the chairman from like March to August of that year. Sean Spicer also, by the way, tried to say at a press conference, tried to minimize this by saying, oh, you know, he didn't come on with the campaign until late May, June, and then he was gone by August kind of thing, and which is just provenly false. So, all right, no more Sean Spicer. Anyway, this was after the uprising in Ukraine, when the pro-Russian Ukraine leader Yanukovych fled his unbelievably extravagant presidential palace and ran to Russia. And before he left, he hastily attempted to destroy intel and documents by burning them and even dropping them into bodies of water and safes and that sort of thing. But several items, including this ledger with Manafort's name on it and a dollar amount next to it, were not destroyed.
So Ukrainian investigators called it evidence of off-the-book payments from a pro-Russian political party and part of a larger pattern of corruption under the country's former president. Manafort, who worked for a party as the international political consultant, was publicly questioned about the, or has publicly questioned, excuse me, the ledger's authenticity. Now, financial records newly obtained by the Associated Press confirmed that at least $1.2 million in payments listed in the ledger next to Manafort's name were actually received by his consulting firm in the United States. They include payments of 2007 and 2009, providing the first evidence that Manafort's firm received at least some money that was listed in the so-called black ledger. Two payments came years before Manafort became involved in the Trump campaign, but for the first time, this bolsters the credibility of the ledger that Manafort formally questioned. This also put the ledger in a new light, as federal prosecutors in the U.S. have been investigating Manafort's work in Eastern Europe as part of a larger anti-corruption probe.
Yeah, and, you know, previously Manafort and Manafort had maintained the ledger was fabricated, said no public evidence existed, that Manafort actually received payments. The AP, however, the Associated Press, identified in the records two payments received by Manafort that aligned with the ledger dollar for dollar. One for $750,000 that a Ukrainian lawmaker said last month was part of a money laundering effort that should be investigated by U.S. authorities. The other was $455,249, which, I mean, I'm sure you could say $750,000, you know, that's just kind of a general amount. That could be anything. But $455,249 is a very specific amount of money.
Right, I'm surprised there isn't, like, cents at the end of that one. But, yeah.
No, there's no sense here. Just to be sure we're all aware, this investigation is separate from the one being conducted by the FBI to determine if there were communications between members of Trump's campaign staff and Russians working to affect the election. This is an entirely different thing that also connects Paul Manafort to Russia. And these events took place before Manafort became Trump's campaign chairman, so he was already on the payroll of a Ukrainian who is extremely pro-Russian and is now hiding in Russia. Latest news that we've seen on this today, this just happened shortly after this news broke, we learned that Paul Manafort is expected to register now as a foreign agent. A foreign agent, so that he can resolve questions about his past work for Ukraine. And this is according to sources briefed on talks between Manafort's lawyers and the Justice Department.
Performed by the former Michael, or the he's still Michael Flynn, the former...
Yes. Oh, right. Yes, right. Because he's on the payroll for Turkey.
Right. Yeah. Right. Or, and he always has been. How do we not know that? I guess we should have vetted it. I think one of the interesting things about these stories, and I think we see a lot of them regarding Trump's connection with Russian oligarchs or certain things, is like if you look back at Watergate and stuff like that, like it wasn't just like they came out and wrote the Watergate story, but like, oh, this burglary had to do with, like, was performed by, it was, like, sanctioned, or it was put together by Nixon, and it was right. All part of a thing. Mm. It was a series of stories that came out, and that goaded sources who knew something more about that to come forward to the journalists, who they assumed were already on the trail, to create a bigger story. Like, so, I mean, there's a whole lot of, like, convoluted stories that are kind of, like, happening and kind of circling around the Trump administration. But I feel like a lot of them, especially about the Post and other stuff, like if ever seems like kind of weak or really convoluted, like I think that might be their play as far as like news organizations.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. This is I would like, so again, to the Republicans or Trump supporters who feel that the recent conflict between Russia and the United States through Syria in any way vindicates Donald Trump or Russia in election hacking, in stealing the election, in plotting against Hillary Clinton, think again. Because this sort of stuff just keeps piling up. Mm-hmm. There's smoke everywhere. They're going to find the fire.
Yeah.
All right. We are going to take a real quick break. We will be right back. You are listening to Tell the World on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. You know, when we had the idea to use that song, or Sean had the idea, I should say, to use that song for a break music, I gave it a listen to, and I was like, oh, that seems kind of risque, kind of offensive to maybe people of Japanese descent. I Googled it. Mm-hmm. This song was extremely popular in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
Even though it kind of has a tongue-in-cheek reference, they say Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Mm-hmm. This song is still popular. It still gets performed in Japan.
It's really
today.
Yeah, Wanda Jackson's like such a like an old school rock star, and I was just like just rockabilly, but like I love Wanda Jackson so much.
I was kind of wondering when I saw the album cover, and it's like, you know, an album from 1960 mm-hmm. called Rockin' with Wanda. Wanda is sitting next to a rocking chair. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, this is not going to be good. That was great.
Yeah,
actually,
it's a great song. I love that song.
All right, well, so a little bit more national news.
There's so much international.
There's so much international and national news, but we're going to get down to Texas in a minute here, I promise. So as you've probably heard, it got a little lost in Syria now, I know. Mitch McConnell and the Republican-led Senate changed the rules by eliminating the ability of Democrats, or anybody really, to filibuster, and easily confirmed Neil Gorsuch as the next Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Now, Republicans, who previously refused to even give Obama's nominee Merrick Garland a job interview, decided that Democrats were treating Gorsuch unfairly and pressed the button on the so-called nuclear option. Democrats were just being so mean
to
him.
So mean about it. Oh, man, but there's something to be said about, like, I think for, like, a while ago during the election, we were trying to figure out, like, I was trying to come up with some, like, weird fantasy football metric for who would win or whatever.
Yes,
who was going to be the Republican rock star. Mm-hmm. Mitch McConnell, that steely-eyed son of a gun, like, that guy is running that company. Like,
he has been single-handedly responsible for many, many big changes in this country
like
over
Paul,
the last few years.
Yeah, like, Paul Ryan with Ryan Care, it's just like, it just has nothing, can't hold a candle to Mitch McConnell, and like he's the company man for the GOP. It's absurd.
Yeah. Now, actually, before I go on, I used to think that way about Boehner, and now you listen to Boehner now, and he criticizes everyone equally, which I think Boehner's a really smart guy, so it's really refreshing to see.
Yeah.
Just thought I'd throw that out there. If you ever have an opportunity, I think Vice did a really good show where part of it was they interviewed Boehner. Really intelligent guy. And you probably might not think so if you politically oppose him, because that's the way we do politics in this country sometimes. Give him a chance. Well, back to the nuclear option. While many critics have decried the rule change as the death of America's greatest legislative and debating body, Senate Democrats sort of shrug their shoulders. For them, it was already over when Mitch McConnell threatened to change the rules the first time, because they knew that if they didn't acquiesce to his request this time, he was just going to keep threatening it if he didn't get his way. They knew that there was going to come a time where they did not want to lay down and let the Republicans have what they wanted, and Mitch McConnell would then just, you know, pull the trigger. So now Democrats will be in a position where if they regain control, they're going to be able to pass anything they want as well. This isn't like it affects Democrats only. This just gets rid of the filibuster.
Right.
So, and this is actually the very reason some Republicans were against the change. Now, one of the best things about American democracy is often said to be the bureaucracy. It makes it harder to get things done when both sides have to agree, but it makes for long-lasting decisions that people can be satisfied with, or at least can live with. Especially with the polarization of the voter base now, this seems like a really bad time to give lawmakers the ability to... you know, we just went from 8 years of George Bush to, and we had Clinton before that, Clinton and then Bush and then Obama and then Trump. And, you know, if we had everything swing complete Democrat and Republican each time, we're talking about complete policy changes every 4 to 8 years, depending on who's in power, just being able to override the other side and everything that they had done previously. And this Gorsuch vote, by the way, I mean, this is early in Trump's presidency, at least, and, you know, there's going to be a lot of things pushed through the Senate if it stays Republican-controlled.
So I really like this story. I think I could talk about this for a while. I think, like, going back, one of the weird conundrums is that I've been sitting on that word today, is that, so America, as it was formed, in contrast to a monarchy, like, basically created the state version of like a speedboat versus a barge. You know what I mean? Like it was like, oh, like we can adapt and we have like all these power checks and everything, so we don't go too crazy, but we're able to, you know, to navigate the oceans as it were better than a monarchy, which changes slowly. And so like they came up with this great idea of a contemporary modern republic. And so like that's why you see here some voices, especially from younger Democrats, that they are okay with this, that they're okay with the idea of like taking the filibuster out. It's just old French word for pirate or something. And
is it really?
Yeah,
I had no idea.
Filibustier or whatever, but it probably goes back even farther than that. And so they're okay with doing away with it. In fact, like there's even the question of like, will they do away with just the legislative filibuster, just the bare bones, just if you're just bringing up a normal law to be passed in the Senate. Should we just do away with that filibuster? No more Mr. Smith goes to Washington stuff. Let's just do the work and move on. I mean, which is interesting, but at the same point, to contrast that, you have the what you would assume would be the constitutionalist original interpretation position of the Republican Party, but I guess not, because it's a Senate rule. It's not the Constitution.
It depends on if we're talking about Supreme Court justice.
It's totally different. Yeah, it's our Supreme Court justice, so it's different. But yeah, it's like, so you have these people who are like, oh, the Constitution should never be changed, but the Senate rules don't matter. but the argument for that is like this, George Washington referred to it as the saucer dish for the tea, which other than clearly displaying for you how different America is in the past 200 years, is the idea that like when things get kind of like the House is a bunch of rabble rousers, bunch of people just screaming it out, getting the fist fights. Then it goes to the Senate where everybody's more deliberative and everything slows down and make sure that you do it right. And, you know, 100 people come together and, you know, make something that works. So you allow the tea to cool as it comes from the House. And so that's gone. And so like it's like what is lost there? What is lost? And like obviously the easiest thing to say is a president no longer has to nominate judges. Thanks to Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell, you never had to nominate a judge who is in the middle of the road that everyone can agree with and you think would best represent the American people. Now you only have to elect a judge you think would serve your purposes best.
And you know, and what you said, I think is true about a lot of young Democrats. Kind of, you know, when I say Republican, or I'm sorry, when I say Democrats, shrug their shoulders about this change. It was mostly because they knew that if this was going to be threatened, it was going to happen eventually. Get it over with, and you know, don't let the Republicans try to hold this over you. But what you're saying about younger Democrats being okay with this and just being like, well, whatever, we're going to be in power because the Trump administration is going pretty terribly so far, and it's going to happen. We've got elections in 2 years. I think it's really irresponsible. What I would like to see is and I consider myself a young voter. I mean, I turned 30 this year. I'm a millennial, technically. I think a lot of millennials don't know they're millennials. They go, oh, these darn high school kids, these millennials. Like, no, sir. Anyway, always cracks me up. I would like to see if the Democrats do come back into power in the next 2 years or 4 years or 6 years or whenever it may occur, because it will eventually swing back at some point. I would like to see them immediately change this rule back.
Really?
It might not make any sense from the outset, but I think that the moral responsibility is to restore this legislative body. I think it's the grown-up thing to do, and it might help to mend some of the partisan politics. Now, I guess it's easy to say that now because we don't know what else Republicans are going to force through now that there's no filibuster. So they might have to get in there and undo more damage than just this rule change. But I don't know. That's my opinion, and I think that that would be the responsible course of action.
Yeah, my thing is, and I always get concerned about this whenever Congress makes the news, makes a big splash, which I do a lot. And I'm going to preface this real quick with something that's much more with 2 feet on the ground before I get a little more scary. Rules for the Senate have been changing for a long time. This is not totally unheard of.
Right.
This is not, you know, like the second this happens doesn't mean the country falls apart. That's just that wouldn't be true for me to say. I wish Brian was here. He's much better at civics. He could actually go through the history of it. I know that they exist. I just can't give you the names of the years. I'm a horrible history major. But at the same point, like one thing that concerns me is that the Congress and the congressional body is like super unpopular. And the math that seems to be kind of like the kind of rising in the sky, you have a very like, if you believe everything that they say about Trump being a demagogue and breaking all the rules and just following his own incentive or his own initiatives, and a super unpopular Congress or parliament, it's very easy at some point, even though it would be very unconstitutional, and to be at some point be like, eventually, and it happens a lot in countries all around the world, that parliaments and congresses get dissolved because they're no longer helping anything. Refer mm-hmm. to Venezuela, refer to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And these are like very, not just like developing countries, these are like developed countries. These were first world countries, especially Venezuela. And they had like civil wars and huge political unrest, obviously for other very different outside influences. If you invest your entire country in oil and oil drops, like what do you expect to happen? It's very unfortunate what's going on in Venezuela right now. But like I try to take lessons from that, I guess, as we do in international scope, and get scared for America, I think appropriately, because if you have a very unpopular Congress and people stop believing in it, then if you lose it and you feel that it's okay to dissolve it, we get left with a bigger mess. Like it's mm-hmm. part of our system. It's part of the thing we fight for. It's what the military swears to when they take their positions. So I don't know, just something. I don't want to be fear mongery, but I just want to make sure everybody just kind of goes like, takes their head up, looks around and goes like, oh, this is what happens when we all think that Congress sucks so bad that we can just get rid of it.
Yeah.
Like we still need it. Just think sometimes it has to adapt to what we're going through.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, you know what? We might talk a little bit more about Donald Trump's positions in a little bit. I want to go ahead and get into Texas,
okay.
though.
Cool.
So we know that the Texas legislature is in session. Mm-hmm. It only meets every 2 years. In 2015, the U.S. Supreme Court made their decision to legalize same-sex marriage across the nation. And except for a few minor hiccups, that time Ken Paxton suggested clerks could ignore the ruling and then quickly corrected himself under threat of many lawsuits, marriage licenses have been distributed to all people across the state of Texas without incident. Okay, without incident. But the Republican-dominated Texas legislature is making it a priority to use this legislative session to respond to that ruling. And yesterday, they voted to let county judges and other elected officials recuse themselves from issuing marriage licenses if they have personal religious objections. The bill won preliminary approval in the Senate, 21-10, with full Republican support and all but one Democrat opposing it.
So, should this bill become a law, it would almost certainly be challenged as unconstitutional by federal lawsuits. Opponents say it sanctions discrimination and defies the nation's highest court. The bill's sponsor, Senator Brian Bridwell of Cranberry, Texas, said about the bill, quote, "If we don't do this, we are discriminating against people of faith," end quote.
And this is, you know, this isn't a full stop measure, I will say. Not that this really makes it any better. The proposal only applies in cases where other officials, without objections, agree to step in for the recusing party. So basically, if you and your partner, your husband, your wife, go to get a marriage license and the person there says, "I'm not going to do it," they're only actually allowed to not do it if someone else can do it. They even also have a stipulation in there that a clerk or judge from another county can issue it electronically so you're not inconvenienced and there isn't a delay. So basically, you know, you're only allowed to do it if someone else will issue that license in your place. But Senator Sylvia Garcia, a Houston Democrat and former judge, you may have heard of her, said Tuesday that the law was unnecessary since Texas officials have been issuing marriage licenses for nearly 2 years without objection. She said the bill will let many Republican officials now stop doing so, not because they have legitimate religious-based problems with gay marriage, but because they want to take ideological stands that will impress local primary voters.
Yeah, and And this would obviously just, like, slow things down. Like, I don't know. Texas legislation does this a lot to my brain.
Well, and they do it, you know, most recently we've seen them doing it with Planned Parenthood, where they know that they can pass whatever law they want down here mm-hmm. in Texas, and it's going to take time for the Supreme Court to address any unconstitutional law that is passed.
Right.
So in that time, now when it comes to abortion rights, the goal is, you know, clearly, we're going to do as much damage as we can. We're going to get as many babies born and avoid as many abortions as we can before they do this. It's sort of a time crunch thing. So now you have, you know, with elections, you know, coming up in the next couple of years, this is a prime time to address this because the Supreme Court has a lot on their docket. This isn't even in there yet because it's not even technically passed. So it will take a while to get to them. That's a lot of campaigning time to say, well,
I fought for this.
I would not personally give someone a gay marriage license because Jesus, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah, and once again, to evoke the spirit of Brian, I think like one of my biggest contentions with this kind of action is that you're wasting state money.
You are.
In a state that is constantly getting less money because of the cost of gas and everything's going down, that's where we got most of our money. There's other budgetary concerns as well. We're not poor. It's just that we're not as rich as we used to. We're not.
Yeah.
We're not,
we do have the Texas Rainy Day Fund.
Right. But like it's called the Rainy Day Fund aptly.
It's not supposed to be spent to fix the mistakes of the legislature.
Exactly. And especially considering like the woes of, CPS and other such things. Anyway, so the thing is like, when the state has to go to the Supreme Court to defend their bull honky, legislation, like we have to spend money to hire lawyers and everybody to represent us, and it's not for free. And if anyone who's ever been to court knows that court is not cheap, especially not like Supreme Court and higher courts. So it's just like it's a waste of our money.
Haven't we already wasted enough money paying Ken Paxton's legal bills?
Right.
Come on. Well, the Senate defeated Democratic amendments seeking to weaken the bill. Amendments seeking to weaken the bill, including one that would have docked the pay of county clerks refusing to issue gay marriage licenses, which is one of those, like, kind of just screw you amendments they throw in there that they know won't get through, but it's just kind of a...
I think that Monster may be like, that might be, like, a labor force violation.
Maybe. It's just a legislative middle finger, though, really. But it's important to note, laws similar to Texas's, in the last couple of years, all across this country, North Carolina comes to mind, these religious freedom bills, this sort of thing, they haven't survived court challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Just last summer, a federal judge struck down a provision in a Mississippi law that had allowed county clerks to recuse themselves from issuing gay marriage licenses because of religious objections. These laws do not ever work. They do not stand. We're wasting time. We're wasting money.
Right.
It's stupid.
It is very stupid.
I try not to use the word stupid too much in politics because you just sound like a jerk. Oh, this is stupid.
Yeah.
You know what? It's stupid. I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's going back, I forgot to bring up the Goodwin principle back to whenever Spicer got brought up Hitler. I don't know.
Yeah.
Every argument eventually ends with Hitler.
Right.
Once you bring up Hitler, you've lost and the argument's over.
It's that number one political. I mean, if you're in politics, just don't be the guy that brings up Hitler.
Yeah. Don't say you're just being dumb and don't bring up Hitler.
Okay, we've got a few minutes left. I really want to talk about this next story because it's a little eye-opening, I think. All right, so Texans, it's time to test your knowledge of state history. Does the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo ring any bells?
Not to me, and I'm, once again, the worst history major on earth.
Really?
No.
I thought I was the worst, but I remember this from Texas. Texas history
class.
Good on
you. Seventh grade was a while ago.
Was it seventh?
Yeah.
Whew. Longer for some of us, Sean. Signed in 1848, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was the treaty that made Texas out of Tejas and also gave the U.S. California, Arizona, and New Mexico. It was signed 2 years after the United States invaded Mexico in a war to seize territory from our southern neighbor, who used to be our southern and western neighbor, I guess. We call it the Mexican-American War. Mexicans refer to it as the U.S. invasion of Mexico. We know that history is often written by the victors, and it ended with the U.S. taking half of Mexico's territory as their own, fully half, manifest destiny, indeed. Mm. Well, now some Mexican lawmakers have proposed a lawsuit that would aim to nullify the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, in which Mexico, invaded by American soldiers, its capital occupied, its ports and customs stations seized, was forced to accept the American annexation. The treaty would have to be brought before the International Court of Justice. Right. But the United States doesn't really recognize compulsory jurisdiction from this court in contentious cases, which, you know, giving up California, Arizona, I almost said Africa for some reason, New Mexico, Texas, would be somewhat contentious to us, I think. So basically, nobody could force us to give it back, no matter what this court decided. And it's not likely that this case would win anyways. Under the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, quote, it must be shown that the state did not expressly agree that the treaty is a valid instrument or that, by reasons of its own conduct, that state must be considered as not having acquiesced to the validity of the treaty. Well, you know, we did occupy their capital city and bomb their ports and this sort of thing and cut them off from Spain. However, in the end, they voluntarily agreed to this treaty. So,
so it still rides.
Yeah. So this is not the, you know, it's not the case with this treaty. But winning might not be the point of the lawsuit. And here's why. To Donald Trump, Mexican immigrants are easily dismissed as drug dealers, bad hombres, illegals. He has declared several times that Mexico should pay for the wall and that its people are stealing from America. But, you know, Mexico was actually one of the first nations to fall victim to American imperialism and American expansionism. And its people, well, formal nations, not counting Native American nations,
right.
And its people remember the war between our countries as an unprovoked conquest, which left 100,000 Mexican citizens north of the border after the annexation. There are descendants of Native American Mexicans, basically, that got nothing out of this deal. For Mexicans, the U.S. president is now telling them to pay for a wall to keep themselves out of the land that the U.S. took from them by force. This lawsuit may represent a way for Mexico to educate their northern neighbors on how they see it and how they feel they were discriminated against, similar to the way Native Americans were treated. Some Mexicans have even called for reparations for the land their ancestors were kicked off of after that war. Now, it might serve a political purpose that is also somewhat thanks to Trump in another way. If the current Mexican administration doesn't take up this case, this cause, it could be taken up by an opposition party. There are elections coming up in Mexico soon. Basically, a presidential candidate could use this lawsuit as a banner to get votes. Elect me and I will sue the United States and take back our lands. And who's going to pay for it? America. Sound familiar? Make Mexico más grande again. Yes.
I think it's, what was it? Hace Mexico, what was it? Estupendo otra vez. No, I don't think that works.
You know, 3.5 years of Spanish, and I'm a terrible Texan. I only know enough to work in the kitchen at various restaurants that I've worked at, and you know, that sort of thing. My Mexican is very pedestrian.
Hold on, I think I got
Spanish.
Hace Mexico, no luego, genial.
I just said Mexican. This is terrible. I apologize. I'm tired. My Spanish is very pedestrian.
Mine too.
See, Brian's not here and everything's falling apart and I'm being insulted. I'm so sorry. I mean, obviously this is a lawsuit that doesn't hold any water. But it's interesting because we have this image in this country that we've built up over years that people that come from south of the border are lazy and uneducated and they steal from us and everything
All
else.
All Mexicans came from over the border recently as right. opposed to over the, like they were here before and they've been coming since they like the 1900s and before that.
Yeah, I mean, they've been here.
Yeah.
And so I think that really the point of this lawsuit is, you know, it could be perverted for a political use, and it very well could be because they do have elections coming up, so whatever, can't really blame them because Donald Trump just did it here. But it would be interesting to see if this gets international headlines, if they go to this court, and especially if the court agrees with them, which is something we wouldn't recognize, but it would be an interesting turn of events.
Mm-hmm.
I think it will kind of help to illustrate to people that, you know, Mexico, for what our relationship is, from what we made it and what it could have been, has been a great neighbor for like 170-something years for us. They've been fantastic. We do trade deals with them. People come and go across the border all the time. And hopefully this will serve to show people that we're kind of being jerks.
However,
nationally.
I always love whenever the World Court or whatever goes up to the U.S. and says, hey, knock it off. And then the U.S. and it's... And in a very U.S. way says, I don't have to listen to you. I made you, so whatever. And just never listens to them whatsoever. It's pretty awful.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us for another installment of Tell the World. Brian will return next week.
Mm-hmm.
My name is Jason.
My name is Sean.
And have a good night.
You are listening to KPFT Houston, which is supported in part by Houston Community College. HCC offers a wide variety of courses and degrees with affordable education for academic advancement, workforce training, career development, and lifelong learning. Summer enrollment at Houston Community College is currently open, with summer classes offering hands-on education, one-on-one tutoring, and small class sizes for students to advance their degrees. For more information on enrollment and programs, visit hccs.edu.
AIDS Foundation Houston is offering free VIP passes to Houston Splash, one of the largest LGBT events of the year. Quantities are limited. While supplies last, get tested for HIV and learn about PrEP, a daily HIV preventative medication. You will receive a free VIP pass to Houston Splash. Free walk-in testing is provided at AIDS Foundation Houston and at many pop-up testing sites. For appointments, call or text 832-436-3798. More information at AIDSHelp.org. This is KPFT Houston.
Today's the day. You, a family member, or your ex has an old vehicle in your garage. It needs to go. So why not clear up some headaches and do something good for yourself and the city in the process? Just call 855-KPFT car now. We'll arrange to come take the vehicle out of your hands. Not running? That's okay. We'll have it towed away at no cost to you. You'll get a tax deduction and even better, not have to worry about it ever again. Just call 855-KPFT-CAR right now. Don't wait. There's no time like the present. 855-KPFT-CAR to donate that vehicle this hour. Thanks. This is KPFT Houston.